Oh, yeah. And actually, right, that'll first candle will be lit.
Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome back to winter. But doesn't March come in like a lion? So let's wait till the end of the month. This morning, we welcome Rabbi Sam Siegel to our congregation. He currently serves as the Interfaith Chaplain at Massachusetts Eye and Ear and Per Diem On-Call Chaplain at Mass General. He also serves the Dover Congregation Temple Israel. Prior to this, Rabbi Siegel served as an interim rabbi working with congregations in transition. For the majority of his professional career, Rabbi Siegel provided geriatric chaplaincy services for 21 years in facilities in Phoenix and Boston. He was a lecturer on spiritual care and support for persons with Alzheimer's and their families. Also, understanding the spiritual dimensions of life transitions and communal systems. He was a presenter on the history and development of American Jewish humor and storytelling as a way of understanding Jewish theology. He has met with our neighboring faiths classes twice and knows what kind of questions you use tend to ask. Our chalice this morning will be lit by Jim Weber and Donna Jensen. You've got one tiny moment in time for life to shine. We will be the light. Join me in saying our covenant. Love is the doctrine of this church.
Quest for truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and communion, to serve humanity in fellowship, to protect the nurturing power within all of us, thus to be covenant.
Mary, wait. I have a reading by a UU minister, Sean Parker Dennison. He says, about 6 months ago, I got a new tattoo. It's a lit match on my right wrist, added to an armful of paintbrushes, pens, and other art supplies. As a minister, my tattoos are sometimes controversial, and I was a little nervous about what people would think about this addition. When people asked why I chose a lit match, I joked that it was either to burn the world down or to light my inner chalice. These days, the joke is less funny because things have gotten more serious. As the new president signs executive orders that give tax breaks to the most privileged while attacking immigrants, refugees, Muslims, GLBTQ people, people with disabilities, and anyone else he disagrees with, I am more and more committed to resistance. This deepened call to a life of noncompliance
will take a lot of burning and a lot of light. As an artist and religious leader, I believe in the necessity of creative destruction. A magnet on my refrigerator says, "Go forth and set the world on fire." That was Saint Ignatius of Loyola. For me, it's a statement of passion and a reminder that in order for justice to flourish, injustice must be dismantled. In order for freedom to be real, fences, cells, and walls must be torn down. In order for forests to remain healthy, wildfires must burn away the overgrowth. I am ready to embrace creative destruction as one of the tools we need in these times. But we need more than destruction. We also need to support each other, lighting the flame of our common chalice, real or symbolic, is a powerful reminder that we cannot sustain ourselves by ourselves. We are not enough individually, and enclaves of like-minded people are not enough. We need each other to share the wisdom of lived experience, to remind each other to keep learning, and to love each other through the inevitable failures and eventual success of our resistance. We need both the burning and the light. Let us sing our children out.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to share with you today a few thoughts out of the Jewish tradition. I begin with some readings from the Bible, both because I was asked to pick some readings from the Bible, and also because they serve as the introduction to what I will later talk about when we get to my talk time for this morning. So you need to listen carefully. There's just five verses from the Bible. They're listed in your program, so if you want to go home and check them at some point, make sure I pick the right ones, you can. But you need to hear what they're saying and perhaps even think about that for a few minutes before I tell you what I think about what they say. The first is Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, which says that God created Ha'adam, and not translated because it doesn't mean man, it means the Adam, which probably the best translation is earthling, because we are told that Adam came from Adama, which is the word for earth. So this is the creature created out of the earth. So God created the earthling in God's own image. In the image of God, God created him. Male and female, God created them. That's chapter 1, verse 27. In chapter 2, verse 7, it says, "And the eternal God fashioned the Adam, the earthling, from the dust of the earth, and breathed into the nostrils the breath of life, and the Adam became a living being." The next two, Psalm 8, verse 5, says that you have made the person a little lower than the angels and crowned each person with glory and honor. That's in contrast and in relationship to chapter 2, verse 7 of Genesis. Then in Psalm 24, verse 1, it says, "The earth belongs to God and everything that is in it, the world and all who live there." And yet in Psalm 115, verse 16, it says, "The heavens belong to God, but the earth has been given to people." A couple of readings from the Bible for this morning.
Thank you. That was a little love song by Tyler Epstein.
We don't need to be reminded of what a loving and supporting congregation we are. Anyone with a joy or sorrow, please come forward.
Hello?
Yeah.
My name is Doug Stevens. I don't know if any of you ever listen to or watch on NPR and PBS the StoryCorps, but 2 weeks ago, my brother and I were interviewed by my niece in anticipation of Dr. Seuss's birthday about our childhood experiences with him every summer when he came back to visit his father. So you might want to take a look at that. It was quite interesting.
I have a particular joy today. It's Jonathan Windsor's birthday.
Oh, jeez. It was yesterday.
Was it a joy, sorrow, or announcement?
Hello, my name's Molly O'Day, and I recently finished my winter term at Exeter of my junior year, and that gives me a lot more free time to be back here with all of you. I haven't been here in a while, but I'm very glad to be back. Thank you.
Welcome back.
Hi, I'm Doug Flockhart. Most of you already know that my wife, Eileen, is recovering splendidly from open heart surgery, and my great joy is that she's with me here this morning.
Great. No sorrows this morning? That's great. But for all that is spoken, I'm sure there are other joys and sorrows that reside in the silent sanctuaries of your hearts. For our meditation this morning, we will do the loving kindness meditation. You can do it for yourself, another loved one, or someone you may have conflict with. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be free from danger. May you be at ease. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be free from danger. May you be at ease.
The Hebrew Bible is filled with, depending on your point of view, real contradictions that are mutually exclusive, or apparent contradictions that are mutually exclusive. The first five books of the Bible, called in Hebrew the Torah, is the core, the essence of all of the Hebrew Bible. And in Hebrew, the Torah is also called Eitz Chaim, a tree of life. Why is it called a tree of life? Apparently, for a variety of reasons, many of which are contradictory and mutually exclusive. But one of the answers is that the Torah is like a tree that is alive. So it's not simply a tree of life, but a living tree. And trees, as long as they are alive, continue to grow and branch in apparently contradictory and certainly random directions, as far as we can see. And so the Torah is available to us to continue to branch and to grow throughout life. These mutually exclusive, contradictory statements in the Bible create then a paradox whenever they are read side by side, as I did this morning. And in Judaism, the tradition is that the Bible, and the Torah especially, is the essence of life. It is planted within us, and we are planted on it. Life is Torah, Torah is life. And so if Torah and Bible are filled with paradox, then so is life. The question is, what do we do with a paradox when we run across it? What do we do with apparently contradictory statements that we cannot follow at the same time? And I gave two examples of readings this morning that seem to set that up for us. Interestingly, by the way, Genesis chapter 1, verse 7 has a second contradictory parallel passage in chapter 2 that I didn't read. Chapter 1 said, in that first story of creation, that God created man, Adam, earthling, a bipedal, upright, intelligent, seeking being, separate from all of the other animals. And God created him, male and female, God created them. So even within the text itself, there's a contradictory statement in the Hebrew, because it says God created him, God created them. Which is it, him or them? Him or male and female them? And then in chapter 2, verse 22, we're told that the Adam, the earthling, was lonely. And so God created a woman and brought the woman over to the man. And the man said, lost in most translations, this time this woman is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. As if there was another time. And in fact, the Torah seems to say, in chapter 1, God created male and female. In chapter 2, God created a guy, and out of the side of the guy came a girl. So which is it? I spent an hour yesterday morning at our first of our adult education series called Myths and Monsters in Genesis, dealing with just those two verses. So you'll have to go check those out for yourself. But the answers that the tradition came up with are a whole variety of answers to how can it be male and female, and then male and female out of the male. So I'm not going to deal with that one, because it doesn't matter which answer you get. And that often is going to be, as you'll see this morning, the role of wrestling with paradox in Judaism, is finding the road to deal with it is more important than where you end up. Wrestling with the paradox is much more crucial most of the time than resolving the paradox. The reason I picked the two sets that I did today is If it is philosophical, resolving the paradox is foolish at best. Wrestling with the paradox leads to wisdom. If it is practical, then resolving the paradox is crucial, but it gets resolved in two different ways, which leads to another paradox. Often when I'm asked, actually, to speak about what is the Jewish view on, fill in the blank, the answer is, which answer would you like? And I usually start that with, what's the most common Jewish way of answering a question? And everybody immediately knows the answer. And they say, with another question. And that is wrong. That is the second most common way in Judaism to answer a question. The first most common way is, let me tell you a story. Because in Judaism, the reason it seems like questions are answered with questions is because there's a recognition that every time you come up with an answer, the answer creates two new questions. So also paradox. So let's look at them. God created a man and a woman out of the dust of the earth, Genesis tells us. And then Psalm, the first reading, which was Psalm 8, says, God has created us a little lower than the angels, a little less than divine. And so the question is, which is it? Are we under everybody's foot? Are we over everybody's head? Are we trampled upon by everything? Or are we above and just almost with God over everything? How do we resolve that? Which is it supposed to be? The answer for that one, since it's not a practical question, was very easy. Yes. And in fact, a practical solution to that question was developed. And that is, while you are alive, everyone should always wear one garment with two pockets. Apparently, women's designers have not learned the Jewish view of clothing, because there's only one time that you wear an item with no pockets, and that is your burial shroud. You no longer need the pockets. What do you need pockets for? They said, in one pocket, you carry a little scroll. And the scroll says, from Genesis chapter 2, I was created out of the dust of the earth, beneath the feet of all. And in the other pocket, you carry a scroll that says, from the Psalms, I was created a little lower than the angels, a little less than divine. And you always carry both of those statements with you. So you live with the paradox. But you live with them in your pockets. You just have to know they're there. You just have to know that the essence of humanity is both the basest of all and the grandest of all. We live with the knowledge that we are both. And yet at times, we ask, which is it? And of course, at times, we need to resolve the paradox, but we only resolve it for the moment. Things are going well. You're really on top of the world. You're in great shape, filled with the joys. And you even build into your service joys and sorrows. Welcome to the paradox of life. You're filled with the joys, no sorrows to report at all. So you reach into the one pocket and you pull out and you say, I've been created out of the dust of the earth, underneath everybody's feet. Sometimes you need a little humility, a little bringing down. Then there are the times that the sorrows seem to be overwhelming. We are drowning in sorrow. Our own self is called into question. What am I doing here? Why? We reach into the other pocket and we say, you have been created a little lower than the angels, a little less than divine. And we remember that there's always something to lift us up, some place to strive for a little bit higher. So we resolve when we need to resolve. And most of the time, God willing, we live in the middle. I don't say, God willing, we live with all joys all the time. Because you're in for a big letdown if you think that's going to happen. Most of the time, our best prayer is, I'd like to live with both scrolls in my pockets. And I don't need to look at either one. Because I'm right here in the middle. Below the heavens, above the earth. Here I am in the middle. No need for any real resolution, but rather the prayer, may I always live with those scrolls well in my pockets, always available if I need them. The other two come from the Psalms, also contradictory, because in Psalm 24, it says, the earth belongs to God and everything that is in it. And in Psalm 115, it says, the heavens belong to God, the earth has been given to people. So again, which is it? Is this God's world or our world? And that one has practical implications. And so the rabbis came up with a practical answer to the practical implications of the paradox. And their answer, of course, starts with, as you guessed, yes, the earth belongs to God, and the earth has been given to people. But on a practical sense, what do we do with that? And the rabbis created a whole series of blessings. You may know a few of them if you've ever been to a Jewish meal that has been done by someone in a traditional style, and you notice they may have said some blessing over grape before they eat the meal. They may say some blessing over bread before they eat the meal. Those are not blessings of thanksgiving. Those are not grace. Judaism does not say grace before a meal. Judaism says grace after the meal. We do not thank for that which we have not received. We thank after we got it. The blessings that are said prior to the meal are part of several pages of available blessings that are said. Traditionally, according to the rabbis, if you want to enjoy something in this world, you have to first recognize God's presence in that thing that you are going to enjoy. And then they expanded it and said, if you are going to experience, if you are going to partake, if you are going to be a part of anything in this world, you have to make a statement of recognition of God's presence in that thing before you enjoy, experience, partake, or participate in. The blessings that are said are statements of God's presence in, not thanks to God for. And so, for example, if you're outside and you see a rainbow, and perhaps you want to enjoy seeing that rainbow, you are not allowed to enjoy seeing that rainbow before you say the one-line blessing, recognizing that God made the rainbow. The interesting thing about that one, which is why I chose that one specifically to start with, is the blessing is, blessed are you, eternal our God, ruler of the world, who remembers the covenant. The rainbow is a sign of the covenant. It is God's promise way back in Genesis that despite global warming, the waters will not exceed the heights of the mountains. Florida, Cape Cod, and Portsmouth might go underwater, but Barrington and Rochester will still be above. God will no longer flood the world. So it's interesting, when we recognize God's presence in the rainbow, we also say, remember God, you promised. And then you can enjoy the rainbow. If you go to the ocean and you haven't been for a while, there's a blessing for seeing the ocean. Go up to the mountains, yeah, there's a blessing for the mountains. If you're about to eat some fruit, there's a blessing for the fruit. Vegetables, there's a blessing for the vegetables. Bread, fruit of the vine, things that are none of the above, there are other categories of food. Things that are made from flour, but they're not bread, there's a blessing for that one. You see a deformed person, there's a blessing for that one. You experience a death, there's a blessing for that one. Because everything that happens in life is at God's hands. So what is this thing that we're saying blessings every time we want to experience something that is in this world? Every time we want to partake. And the tradition also said further, if you say a blessing for something, if you recognize God's presence in something, then you have to partake of it. So you can't say the blessing for the rainbow unless you actually go and see one. You can't say a blessing for a piece of vegetable unless you then eat one. Every time you've said the blessing, you then have to do whatever the blessing came to. What was the purpose for all of that? One of the purposes could simply have been, you know, it'd be nice to remind yourself all the time God's around and God did it. But the rabbis couldn't just create that and say, well, I think you should always remember God's present. They needed to find a place where God told us you should remember that God is present. So they went to the Psalms. And in Psalm 24 it says, the earth belongs to God. And in Psalm 115 it says, God has given the earth to people. The rabbi said, aha. Here's the answer. If you say a blessing, God says, here, you can have it. If you don't say the blessing, you've stolen it from God. Psalm 24 is before the blessing, and Psalm 115 is after the blessing. So anytime that you want to partake or will partake in some aspect of God's world, you are in Psalm 24 until you say, you did it, God. And God says, okay, here, have it. God gives us when we recognize God's presence. It was an ingenious way of dealing with it. And as I reminded you, it was a great answer. What's going to come next? More questions. And in fact, the next question was, okay, what happens when that doesn't work? And people would say, what do you mean it doesn't work? Of course it works. It always works. You say a blessing. You fulfill the blessing. You went from Psalm 24 to Psalm 115. It works. And they said, well, what about Friday night? People said, what about Friday night? See, every time there's a question, there's an answer, there's another question. What happens on Friday night? Well, on Friday night, we have a couple of these little guys sitting up there on the bima, at least two candles, and those are the last lights of the old week that then shine into Shabbat and become the first lights of Shabbat. So now we're going to enjoy our Shabbat light. Naturally, we have to say a blessing before we enjoy the Shabbat light. So we say the blessing who has commanded us to light candles for Shabbat. And as soon as we say that blessing, Shabbat begins. Once Shabbat begins, you cannot create a fire. You cannot light a candle. But you've just said a blessing who has commanded us to light the candles of Shabbat. And now that you've said the blessing, you can't light the candles for Shabbat because it's Shabbat and you can't light candles. So I'm going to light the candles before I say the blessing. Then I say the blessing And then I have to fulfill the blessing by lighting the candles, but I already lit them before I said it. So what am I supposed to do? All of a sudden, Psalm 24, 115, resolution doesn't work. So we needed another answer. And the rabbi said, when does Shabbat begin? The answer is not when the sun sets on Friday night. The answer is when we say so before the sun sets on Friday night. The candles are lit at least 18 minutes before the sun sets, lest we actually wait too long, because most people do not live on a totally unobstructed horizon and know when the sun sets. It's not like Gene Wilder in Frisco Kid, where he's trying to wait till the end of Saturday and he keeps going like this till the sun is below the mountain near him. Shabbat begins, the sun sets on Friday night is a reminder that Shabbat begins. But it's only a reminder. Shabbat begins when we say so. And we say so when we say the blessing for the candles before the sun sets. So if we say so, we have the power to create Shabbat. And if you've ever seen a good old Jewish movie, seen Fiddler on the Roof with the Friday night, and she's sitting there going like this and closing her eyes, lights the candles, covers her eyes, says the blessing, uncovers her eyes, looks at the candles, everybody says, oh, isn't that nice? And people, you'll ask them, why are they doing that? Oh, you know, I'm getting myself into the mood. I'm gathering it in. I'm making the Shabbat become really a part of me. I'm focusing. Great. It's not what the rabbi said. It's all the later stuff. What am I doing? I light the candles and then I ignore them. They don't exist because my eyes are closed. I say the blessing while my eyes are closed. And then I open my eyes and the candles become lit. See, I brought the light into me and then I send it out to the candle and poof. The rabbis dealt with existentialism long before any European philosopher. If a candle is lit and you can't see it, is it really burning? And the answer obviously is no. Not burning till you look at it. So you say the blessing, you open your eyes, the candles are lit. You fulfill the blessing. All that from two verses, one verse each in two separate psalms, Psalm 24 and Psalm 115, contradictory, mutually exclusive, until you make them work together. Which came first? The rabbi looking at the two psalms and said, what do we do with that? Or the rabbi is trying to figure out what do we do and then finding a place in the Bible to pin it onto. Good paradoxical question. And the answer is yes.
Thank you, Rabbi Siegel. So, I'm Jim Weber, and I'm representing the Pledge Committee today. And I'm going to be giving sort of three sections to my remarks. First, I'm going to be serious and talk about my experience at Fuse. And then I'm going to be, thank you, Dawn. And then I'm going to be silly, like I usually am. And then I'm going to be sacred. Three S's. So my testimony today is entitled, Fusey is Well-Being. In the UU tradition, spiritual growth is an individual matter. To me, spiritual growth can be framed by the notion of well-being, as described by Dr. Daniel Siegel in his work in Interpersonal Neurobiology, The Brain. He sees well-being as made up of, one, emphatic relationships, two, a healthy mind, and three, an integrated brain. Viewing things this way, our church can be seen as a well-being enabler, facilitator, one that leads to spiritual growth and feeling part of something larger than ourselves. Let me take the three dimensions of well-being and relate it to my experience at this church. First is emphatic relationships, a frequent topic of Kendra Ford's sermons. We enjoy all kinds of relationship-building activities. For instance, we worship together, we celebrate together, we mourn together, we sing together, we work together, we cook together, we dine together, we teach together, we learn together, we build together, we repair together. And all this adds up to, at our best, we stand together, as well as, at times, rocking together. So Kendra showed us how to build a caring community. She urges us to honor our differences and relate to each other through compassionate communication. She teaches that vigorous relationships lead us to a healthy mind and, as we will see, an integrated brain. The second dimension of well-being is then a healthy mind, consisting of all mental processes of an inner subjective nature, our inner world of emotions, awareness, and consciousness, an inner world. Our order of service, as we've seen today, is designed to nourish the mind and to penetrate our detached, objective, and everyday selves. It starts with the singing bowl and the ritual of lighting the chalice. We recite the covenant together. We sing hymns. We listen to choir. We hear provocative reading. We sing our children out for religious education. We share the joys and sorrows of our life. We meditate. We cultivate our mindfulness. We sing some more. We light candles. Not all candles. So that was not part of the silly part. We are challenged by the sermon. We experience the inner joys of altruism at collection time, at pledge time. We celebrate our altruism at the monthly give-it-away service. And finally, we recite the benediction. So all these activities bombard, stretch, and enrich the mind. And as we will see, this creates new circuits in the physical brain and nervous system. So the final dimension of well-being is the integrated brain. As Dr. Siegel puts it, inspire to rewire neurons that fire together, wire together, or, as in my case, at age 85, new neurons for an aging brain. All this occurs through the process of neuroplasticity, changing the brain through experience. There are two types of educational experience that change the structure of the brain: outer education and inner education. Outer education at FUSE includes lifespan religious education, study groups, learn by doing, leadership experiences, workshops, lectures, art classes, service projects, as well as courses offered at the regional level. Inner education focuses on the internal world, the world of the soul and the spirit. It's what happens during church services such as these. It's what happens in the Active Hope study group and small group ministries. Inner education is what happens in yoga classes at Heather Crowley's yurt. She does have a yurt. It's a result of personal spiritual practice that Kendra urges us to adopt. She always is trying to get us involved in a spiritual practice. So inner education takes awareness and reflection, and in turn leads to social and emotional intelligence. Putting these three dimensions together, we see that our church is a well-being enabler, a facilitator of well-being. It is the way I feel after a service. For some reason, I feel better. A sense of well-being. One that integrates relationships, mind, and brain. An integration that leads to spiritual growth and invites us to see beyond ourselves and act in the wider world for the greater good. So now I have pause, sip water. This is my coach. He said, "This there is no water." But I will be edging into the silly part of my comments. My first point, and now I'm on the pledge rule. Give, give, until it hurts. You will feel better. That's kind of nice. Visit the giving table at coffee hour. Make a pledge, or even raise your pledge. At the table, you will see a myriad of attractions. Altruistic button making with the help of youth. Pocket Guide to Interpersonal Neurobiology by Dr. Siegel. An introvert's guide to coffee hour. Including how to start a conversation when you have nothing to say. We also have Kendra Ford's forthcoming book, Bibliotherapy. Got a problem? Read this book. Still have the problem? Here's the second book. And if all else fails, try the CD. When the cat's away, the mouse will play. This is pause for water here. Thank you. It's time now for the offering to support the work of our church. Please exercise your altruistic being. Your gifts put our faith into action. Yeah, you say something about the candles. Jonathan's going to say something about the candles now.
Candles.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
I have extinguished our chalice fire, but not the light of truth. Let the fire of our passion burn with both light and warmth. In our anger, let us embody the spirit of creative destruction, always making room for more justice, more compassion, more love. May we be the ones that make it so. Let us join in the unison benediction. Go in peace.
Speak truth. Give thanks each day. Respect the earth and all creatures, for they are alive like you. Care for your body. It is a wondrous gift. Be gentle with yourself. Live simply. Be of service. Be guided by your faith and not your fear. Go lightly on your way. Walk in a sacred manner.
I don't know if you've noticed, but the loudest words are, be guided by your faith and not your fear. It's always loudest.
That's what people need to remind themselves about.
Exactly. Exactly. Here, now you get your envelope. Ah, boy.
Yeah, I'll be here.
So out there,
It was just burned to a nub.
I don't know what you